Well, we call our first case of the morning. My notes tell me we have... I'm going to do a terrible job on this first name, but Maranatha Baptist High School. Are you all here? If you are, would you please stand? Very good. Well, thank you. You may be seated.
How do you pronounce the name?
Say it again. Maranatha? So I had the accent on the wrong syllable. Okay. All right, so we will call our first case. Before we go on, if you all can stay after the second argument, a case in which I'm not participating, I will come back and chat with you about proceedings in the Supreme Court and answer perhaps some of your questions about how a case gets here. So if you can either stay, if you're staying on, or if you can come back, it'll be about 5 or 10 minutes after 12. So whenever that is, I'll come back and talk with you all. You will notice Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is not at the bench today. She is not participating in this case, nor is she participating in the next case. So with all of those preliminaries, I will call State versus Cox. And counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May I begin?
Yes, please.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I am Hannah Sheber Jurst, and it is my privilege to be here today on behalf of Michael Cox. One of the most important rules of statutory interpretation is that we interpret statutes in context, not in isolation, but in the context in which the language is used, in relation to the language of surrounding or closely related statutes. The context of the DNA surcharge statute demonstrates that the legislature left sentencing courts with discretion to waive the otherwise automatically imposed surcharge, and it demonstrates that in two ways. First, the context of the victim witness surcharge statute, revised at the same time as the DNA surcharge statute and functioning similarly in format, demonstrates that courts still retain authority to waive the surcharge. And second, the broader context of Chapter 973, which deals with sentencing, recognizes the tremendous discretion that sentencing courts have.
Counsel, assuming we agree with you that the imposition of the surcharge is discretionary, did the trial court here exercise discretion?
Yes, the trial court, the circuit court explained that if Mr. Cox had been previously ordered to provide a DNA sample, it didn't wish him to have to pay the DNA surcharge.
So that's discretion?
Well, the new DNA surcharge statute doesn't require any affirmative exercise of discretion for the court.
So it can just be happenstance. It can just be there's nothing for a reviewing court to determine what the trial court based its decision on. Just if in this instance the defendant had previously provided a sample, then no surcharge. But then defendant B comes along and has provided a sample, then you get a surcharge. That would be the rule of discretion that would be urged upon us today, as far as I can tell.
That's correct, but that's not in any way unusual in Chapter 973 or in sentencing in general. So for example...
That there's no reasoning applied at all?
No, not that, Your Honor, but that there are circumstances in 973 where a court doesn't have to make a separate explanation in exercising discretion beyond the normal sentencing exercise of discretion that's required by Galleon. So as an example, if a court, with regard to the earned release program or challenge incarceration program, a court doesn't have to offer an additional explanation as to why it's saying yes or no. It can just say yes or no. So the same would be true here. The exercise of discretion review is the broader review that's contemplated by Galleon, but a circuit court wouldn't have to do a separate specific exercise of discretion.
Fair enough.
Counsel, if we adopt your position today, Would it then become necessary for the legislature, every time that it used shall in a mandatory sense, that it add a separate sentence saying, and we really mean shall?
It would depend on the particular circumstance. I would note that in Chapter 973 alone, the legislature has used the word shall 337 times. And so I don't think in that, in the wide variety of contexts in which it's used, that would always be required. But what we see from the legislature's decision in the very same act in which it amended the DNA surcharge to add language to the victim witness surcharge prohibiting waiver, what that tells us is that in this context, which is how we analyze statutes, for this type of surcharge, and by this type of surcharge I mean a surcharge that is set up to be imposed on each particular count regardless of the nature of the crime, use of the language shall impose does not in turn equal cannot waive.
Counsel, the DNA surcharge statute 973046 uses the term shall five times in four subsections. Does your rule require that we interpret shall in each of those instances as being directory as opposed to mandatory?
So I'm looking at the statute, and the only use of the word shall from my read that applies to the sentencing court is the one at issue. So the other uses of the word shall refer to the clerk of courts, refers to how the money should be deposited, and refers to the department, meaning the Department of Corrections.
So, so is it your suggestion that we should read the other four instances as being mandatory as opposed to directory?
Yes, I think that's fair, and I think that's consistent with the broader context of Chapter 973.
So how would we distinguish between those instances in which we use shall in the statute, in looking at just one statute, five instances of the term, how do we tell when we read it as mandatory as opposed to directory? What's the philosophical distinction that we're supposed to draw here?
Here that distinction is one is directed at the sentencing court, where in 973 there's the recognition that sentencing courts have broad discretion at sentencing, and the others aren't applicable to the sentencing court.
So why couldn't the sentencing court look at that and say, well, if I've got discretion on whether to impose this or not, why should I not also have discretion in how that's used or how it's collected or not collected or by whom?
Because it's not the sentencing court that's collecting it. The provision of the DNA surcharge statute here says that it shall be deposited by the Secretary of Administration. It's the clerk of courts that's collecting it, and those entities don't have the same recognized presumption of discretion. And again, I would just point to the fact that the legislature's decision in the same act to include language prohibiting waiver of the victim witness surcharge statute also makes sense when we consider the broad discretion that sentencing courts start with.
Let me stop you there. So do you think there might be a different reason why the legislature included that language with respect to the victim witness surcharge and not the DNA surcharge?
I missed part of your question. Could you repeat?
Do you think there might have been a specific reason that the legislature chose to add that language with respect to the victim witness surcharge, but not with respect to the DNA surcharge? Can you think of any historical or factual motivations the legislature may have had to do that?
Beyond reflecting a different intention that that should not be waived?
Beyond that.
Okay. I think if we look outside of the internal composition of the statutes to legislative history, the state identifies the legislative document prepared in 2012 concerning the domestic abuse, the victim witness surcharge, and that document reflects concern that courts were waiving the surcharge and concern that there needs to be sufficient money to cover the victim and witness costs.
So, and I'm not sure we have to look at legislative history. The fact is the courts had been waiving or reducing the victim witness surcharge, correct?
Right.
Okay. And so had the courts been waiving or reducing the DNA surcharge?
That, I think if you look at the Cherry line of cases, you look at Nickel, those cases do reflect that courts were waiving these surcharges, the DNA surcharges.
In the mandatory context?
I'm unaware of any case law that says that for those few statutory offenses under the old DNA surcharge statute where the language said shall, I'm unaware of any cases that reflect waiver in that circumstance.
Right. So the waivers were occurring in the circumstances in which the statute said that the court may impose.
Right.
Okay. So the may reflected the legislature's intention that they should exercise their discretion, right?
Right. It reflected that we're starting for those offenses from the point of the court will not be imposing it unless then the court chooses to affirmatively exercise its discretion to impose it.
And so under those, as the statute existed before this amendment, the circumstances under which the statute said that the surcharge shall be imposed, you understood that to be mandatory, correct?
Well, I think that's as I noted, there's no case law on that. I do think that the presence of may and shall in the same statute, rules of statutory construction tells us that that reflects a difference of intention. But that's no longer there. And what we also know is that when the legislature chose to use now the word shall impose, we also now have the knowledge of its decision to add that language to the victim witness surcharge.
Just so I understand your position on the former version of the statute, is it your position that under circumstances in which the statute would say the court shall impose as opposed to may impose, mm-hmm. that the court still had the discretion to not impose?
I don't know that there's a clear answer to that question because it didn't come up. I would agree that that seems the distinction between shall and may in the old statute more strongly suggests that the legislature would have intended for that not to be waived, but I don't see any clear answer on that question. The legislature's decision in 2013, Wisconsin Act 20, when it revised two surcharges under 973, those being the victim witness and the DNA surcharge statute, to include the language prohibiting the waiver of the victim witness surcharge statute, tells us under multiple rules of statutory construction that in this context, shall impose does not equal cannot waive. And most importantly, the presence of this language unravels the presumption that shall imposes a mandatory requirement, because if shall impose equals cannot waive, there would have been no reason for the legislature to include that language in the victim witness surcharge statute. This court in Welkos and in many decisions since has explained that where a statute with respect to one subject contains a given provision, the omission of such provision from a similar statute concerning a related subject is significant in showing that a different intention existed. And I would note in the Welkos decision itself, this court was addressing, and that's a 1961 decision, I believe, this court was addressing language related to the imposition of certain costs in criminal cases. And this court found significant that in an act where the legislature chose to change the language of one similar statute but not another, that was significant in this court's conclusion that the legislature intended different results. It also tells, under the rule of avoiding surplusage, we also know that there was a different intention. The state's only response to the legislature's addition of this language in the victim witness surcharge statute is to ask this court to, in essence, read that out as unnecessary. But to do that would ignore the fundamental rules of statutory construction. The state's suggestion that that language in the victim witness surcharge statute functions, in essence, as a belt and suspenders function is also misplaced. First, as Justice Scalia and Brian...
No. Counsel, I'm not sure. I may have missed that part of the state's argument. I'm not sure that they're arguing that it doesn't have any effect. Right? In the additional language in the victim witness surcharge statute, because it was addressing a known extant practice of the court of reducing or waiving the surcharge, right?
Right.
How else would the legislature make its will known that should not be that practice should not continue?
Well, I agree that that's what it was doing, but the fact that it chose to do that with victim witness, but didn't then choose to do that with the DNA surcharge, reflects a different intention. And
could it be? That the reason they did it in victim surcharge statute but not in DNA is because there was a practice of waiving or reducing the victim witness surcharge, and there was not a practice of reducing or waiving the mandatory DNA surcharge.
I suppose that's possible. I think we're getting a little bit, if we go down that road, to guessing at what the legislature may have intended to create in these statutes, as opposed to looking at the particular at what they actually did, which is where we have to start. But again, what that tells us is that the legislature did not have that same concern when it came to the newly revised DNA surcharge statute, because if they did have that concern of courts being able to waive or wanting to prohibit courts from waiving the surcharge, it certainly knew how to address that, and it didn't do that. To hold that this is, in essence, a belt and suspenders function, I think would be to depart from the rules that this court articulated in Kalal, where belt and suspenders functions have been recognized are in situations where a statute provides a broad general definition for a term, and then goes on to say including, and then gives a few specific examples. Now, in those situations, one could say, well, the specific examples are surplusage because they're already included in the general definition. But in those circumstances, what the legislature is doing is ensuring that those specific definitions are indeed included in the general. This is very different. Here, the state is asking this court to interpret an entire recently added statutory provision prohibiting sentencing courts from doing something as essentially just extra, that was already covered by shall impose, but the legislature just needed to give it a little extra oomph. I think that runs against the rules of statutory construction.
If we would take your position, how many cases do we have to overrule which indicated or were based on the assumption that this was a mandatory statute?
I don't think it would require this court to overrule any of the ex post facto cases.
Does the court then have to include in its opinion that any statements in any prior case that assumes or states that the surcharge is mandatory is an error, and that it's not mandatory, it's discretionary. Or if you don't like those words, that although the surcharge uses the word shall, the court construes that the trial court may waive it.
That could help, I suppose, in providing clarity. I think the best way to think about the new surcharge statute is that the change was from no surcharge unless there was an affirmative exercise of discretion to an automatically imposed surcharge, something that happens by default. I don't know that this court would have to go back and change that language, but that could be helpful in providing clarity.
Well, as I understood the briefs, and I haven't reread every single case, the indication is that the court has, including the Court of Appeals, has either directly or indirectly assumed that shall means shall, and it's mandatory and not waivable. Now, there isn't a case that says not waivable.
Right.
But that they rest apparently on an either express or implied assumption that shall is mandatory.
Sure.
So we have to do something.
And I think, again, that would be helpful in providing clarity to the courts on that position and the use of the word mandatory. Your Honor is correct that this issue was not at issue in those prior ex post facto cases.
That always worries me because you will read the prior case. It says shall and it says indicates mandatory in some fashion. Key cited or cite the case. We used to say shepherdize, but you probably don't know what that means anymore. And you don't find any reversal. You don't find any note saying of dubious value, you know, a yellow flag or an orange flag or something. And yet the case really is not fully operative.
Sure.
If we do what you want to do.
Right. And that does happen. Right? And in the Anagnos case that we cite in our brief, this court recognized that it will use shorthand terms to describe what's at issue in that particular case, but that does not necessarily mean that those terms will always be completely accurate when in the next case.
Counsel, didn't we actually necessarily address this question in Scruggs? I mean, the whole point of Scruggs was that there was a change in the DNA surcharge statute, mm-hmm. and whereas it used to be permissive, now it was mandatory, and we had to decide whether having made it mandatory that created an ex post facto problem, right?
Right. So that was the analysis in Scruggs. But the U.S. Supreme Court has explained that recognizing that sentencing courts retain some level of discretion doesn't defeat an ex post facto violation. So in the Pew case that we cite in our brief, the U.S. Supreme Court was addressing an ex post facto challenge in the context of the now discretionary federal sentencing guidelines. And the Supreme Court, the government in that situation was arguing that the change in the guidelines wasn't an ex post facto violation because they are no longer under Booker mandatory for a sentencing court to follow. And the Supreme Court rejected that interpretation and said that as long as the change in the law creates a sufficient risk of an increased penalty, that will still violate ex post facto protections. And so here, the change from no surcharge unless an affirmative exercise of discretion to an automatically imposed surcharge unless the court should choose to waive it does create a sufficient risk, and so I think it's consistent with Scruggs. Turning to my second point, the context of Chapter 973 as a whole further supports our interpretation. 973, when we look at it, recognizes throughout the broad discretion that we in Wisconsin give to our sentencing courts. So what we see in 973 is that the legislature sets the outer parameters of a sentencing court's authority, and then at various points cabins a circuit court's discretion or explains where it wants a circuit court to offer a particular explanation in exercising that discretion. So in this context, it's not surprising that the legislature would choose when it would choose in 2013 Wisconsin Act 20 to indicate which of the surcharges it was amending could not be waived as opposed to which one could be waived. The sentencing judge, as we recognize regularly, is in the best position to assess both the needs and concerns of the public and the particular defendant. And as the Court of Appeals recognized in its certification, in a given case, a court may choose to use that discretion to waive all or parts of DNA surcharges to preserve a defendant's ability to meet other financial obligations, such as restitution to the victim. And importantly, recognizing that a circuit court retains discretion to waive the surcharge doesn't require a sentencing court to do anything. As I noted in response to your question, Justice Gableman, A circuit court here can say nothing, and the surcharge will be imposed on every single count. So there's no affirmative requirement on the circuit court to exercise its discretion. And just briefly, to conclude, I want to highlight a recent, very recent decision from this court that I think provides a good example of interpreting the word shall in context. In the Reyes-Fuertes decision, this court addressed 97108's requirement that if a court fails to give an immigration, particular immigration warning, in the context of entering a guilty plea, the language in 97108 says that shall the defendant, if the court fails to do that and the defendant suffers immigration consequences, shall be able to withdraw his plea. This court addressed the tension between the word shall in that statute and shall in 97126, which is the harmless error provision in Chapter 971. And this court explained that it could not read the immigration warning statute in a vacuum. It had to read it in context. The court noted that the two provisions, though not terribly close, in Chapter 971 were part of the same statutory scheme. And this court also considered the broader context of entering guilty pleas and the manner in which we deal with errors at guilty pleas.
But, counsel, we weren't changing the meaning of shall in that case, were we? We were looking at whether the harmless error requirement eliminated the trigger for the plea withdrawal right.
Well, this court was looking at the use of the language shall, because 97108 specifically provides that if a court fails to do give those immigration warnings and the defendant has consequences, he shall be entitled to withdraw his plea. And so this court was addressing two uses of the word shall.
Right. So in what we did, I think, is we interposed the harmless error question in between what the court did and the defendant's right to withdraw his plea. And we said we didn't change the shall nature of the right to withdraw a plea. We simply said there was a break in the causative chain that was caused by the harmlessness of the error.
I see my time has expired. May I respond?
Yes, you may.
Question? Thank you. The court did do that, but in doing that, it had to recognize that one of the shalls should take priority over the other shall. And I think what's important there is this court, in so doing, noted that neither of the shalls were more mandatory than the other in the statute. Here, that's not the case. The legislature has told us that the shall in the victim witness surcharge is more mandatory than the DNA surcharge statute. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please do.
May it please the Court, Deputy Solicitor General Kevin Leroy on behalf of Wisconsin. Prior to 2013's Act 20, the DNA surcharge statute stated that sentencing courts may impose a surcharge on certain defendants. Act 20 amended the statute to state that the courts shall impose a surcharge on all defendants. As this court recognized in Scruggs, this amendment had its intended and expected effect. The DNA surcharge statute is mandatory, leaving no more room for discretion for courts to waive the imposition. Thus, the imposition of the surcharge here was both necessary under the law and appropriate. So we know the DNA surcharge statute is mandatory for four reasons. First is Scruggs itself, in which this court held that the mandatory imposition of the surcharge did not violate the ex post facto clause. A necessary premise of that holding is an interpretation of the statute, interpreting it to be mandatory. So the majority of this court, in the majority opinion, referred to the statute as the, quote, now mandatory surcharge multiple times. It used the word mandatory 23 times, the word discretion or discretionary 12 times, and this is all in reference to the DNA surcharge statute and its statutory history.
And that's not different from other cases in the Court of Appeals.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. So since Scruggs answers this issue, it's an interpretation of this statute, it's a necessary premise of its holding, it's the state's position that just decides the case in the state's favor here.
Counsel, what do you say of Ms. Juris's position that we were perhaps not especially precise in Scruggs and that what we should have done was say there was simply the change in the language simply increased the risk to the defendant that the surcharge might be imposed. But this was not really mandatory. It just went from a statute that gave the court permission to impose the surcharge to a statute that required the court to exercise its discretion on whether to impose the surcharge. What do you make of that argument?
Certainly. So when courts are presented with the shall problem, whether shall is mandatory or discretionary, they usually state that shall either means shall, means mandatory, or it means may, discretionary. I don't think there is this middle ground sort of default rule presumption available. So if the legislature did intend to have that sort of burden-shifting type of interpretation that my friend prefers, it would have needed to use more words. So because they just used the word shall, the only two options available for this court are may, discretionary, pure discretionary, just like prior to Act 20, or mandatory, shall means shall. And so since the court in Scruggs said this is mandatory, it's clearly reading shall to mean mandatory, Scruggs decides this issue. And that really kind of goes into my second point, which is just the statutory history.
What was argued in the Scruggs brief? Did anyone argue it wasn't mandatory?
No one argued it wasn't mandatory, but my...
That's what I thought, and therefore the assumption that this whole case in Scruggs went forward on was that it was mandatory. And then if it's mandatory, is it ex post facto? Isn't that right?
So I disagree with that. It's an assumption.
Okay.
I think it is the court reading the statute. And the reason... So it is true as a general matter. When an issue is not fully briefed and presented to the court, stare decisis has less force. But here, I don't think it was necessary to fully brief the issue in Scruggs because you had this clear statutory history. You had the movement from may to shall. That is the strongest statutory history that I could conceive of when interpreting the word shall. If the legislature did not intend to enact a change there would be no reason for them to have the entire Act 20 amendment. And that really fits well with the general presumption, which I alluded to earlier, that when the legislature uses the word shall, they mean it to be mandatory unless context indicates otherwise.
Well, counsel, Ms. Jers suggests that the clarity of that change got watered down by the simultaneous amendment to the victim witness surcharge in the language that you included there, that essentially said, no, when we said shall, we really meant shall, right? So why does that not water down the clarity with which this change from may to shall would otherwise provide us?
Yes, Your Honor. So it doesn't water down the change from may to shall for the reasons Your Honor alluded to in the previous questioning about the context of the victim witness surcharge. So the legislature had been faced with a reduction in the funding of this surcharge, and it's worth noting this is the surcharge that goes to fund necessary services to the victims of crimes. And so this is perhaps the most important surcharge in all of 973. So if the legislature is seeing a reduction in funding in that surcharge, that means that victims of crimes are not getting the full amount of necessary services that they're entitled to under Wisconsin law. So the legislature has to do something. It can't simply say, we're going to leave it be because the courts are misinterpreting this statute. They have to do something. The only thing that they can do is say, we really mean it. And so that context shows that that extra provision in the victim witness surcharge really is a belt and suspenders function to say, we really mean it. It would be very unfortunate for that sort of attempt to fix a problem for that to backfire and harm other surcharge funding mechanisms. So, you know, an unintended consequence of holding that way might be the legislature being reticent to change these sorts of problems that they see. And, of course, we want the legislature to address the problems in the statutes to say this is how we mean for these to be interpreted. So then say, well, the DNA surcharge statute is now permissive despite the very clear statutory history. I think that would just be very unfortunate for the legislature really trying to do, to solve problems associated with crime. So that's the victim witness surcharge. And that gets into what I think is, my friends, really the main, perhaps the only argument, is the surplusage canon. So surplusage canon, it says the court must give reasonable effect to every word where possible. So we're really relying on that where possible language here, that since this is a belt and suspenders provision, it is not possible to give it an independent effect, independent of the word shall. Therefore, the court does not need to be concerned that the provision in the victim witness surcharge will be in the narrow sense, legally superfluous, in that you don't need it to have it to be mandatory. But in the broader sense, the historical context, it really is doing something. It is correcting what the legislature perceived to be an error in circuit courts waiving the victim witness surcharge. But there's another reason why the surplusage canon does not carry the day here, and that's that there will be surplusage in the very narrow legal sense of that word in Chapter 973, no matter how the court interprets the word shall, whether it be mandatory or permissive. So, for example, there's a provision in the domestic abuse surcharge statute where it says the court shall impose that statute, but then there's another provision that says the court may waive part or all of the surcharge if it determines that the imposition of the charge would have a negative impact on the offender's family. There would be no need to have that extra provision if shall were just merely discretionary. Further, Chapter 973, it uses the word may multiple times to grant discretion in a way that both sides would agree would be discretionary. So, for example, there's a GPS tracking surcharge, and it says the department may increase the surcharge by rule. There's just the general penalty enhancements, the extended supervision condition statutes in 973.01. Those use the words may, saying the court may add conditions or enhance penalties. And then, of course, as I mentioned, there's a domestic abuse surcharge, which uses the word may. It's clearly discretionary. So my friend would like this court to say that Chapter 973 sometimes uses shall to be mandatory, sometimes uses shall to be discretionary, but then sometimes also uses may to be discretionary. And there's no statutory hooks that would guide any courts on how to achieve that balancing act. And furthermore, my friend had mentioned the Challenged Incarceration Program. So that statute says the court shall, as part of the exercise of its sentencing discretion, and then decide eligibility for that program. So if the legislature wants to have a sort of discretionary shall, it knows how to do it. It'll say things like, as part of the exercise of its sentencing discretion. So I had my first reason was Scruggs. My second reason is statutory history. My third reason, and this was alluded to in my friend's presentation, is that the DNA surcharge statute uses the mandatory shall elsewhere in that statute. So, for example, it says the clerk shall determine the surcharge amount due and collect it. So we know that can't be discretionary because the clerk is essentially the employee of the court and so has to follow the court orders. So if there's a mandatory shall directed at the clerk, and then there's another shall directed at the court, under general rules of statutory interpretation, you have to interpret those two shalls to be the same, have the same mandatory meaning here, unless context dictates otherwise, and there is no context that would dictate otherwise. And then my fourth point is just the context of Act 20. So Act 20, it expanded the DNA databank primarily by increasing the collection of the defendants who the DNA would be collected from, and that's going to have extreme downstream effects about how much DNA is analyzed, how much is stored, how much is used for investigative purposes. That costs a significant amount of money for the legislature, and so what they needed to do is increase the funding for the DNA databank. They did that by expanding the DNA surcharge statute, by extending it to misdemeanants and felons, and by making it mandatory. So that statutory context can guide this court in interpreting the word shall if it thinks shall is ambiguous, and interpreting it to be mandatory would further that statutory purpose, which is expressed in Act 20.
Does this court have to do anything to State versus Elwood, which was in a Wisconsin appellate decision, or State versus Radaj, which is also a Wisconsin appellate decision?
So in the court's next case, the state will be asking the court to overturn those two decisions. And so the case here, Cox, does not affect those two because those also said the DNA surcharge statute is mandatory. But the state's position in the next case will more fully address those two cases.
But it's not inconsistent with the state's position in this case.
That's correct. My understanding is those two held that it's a mandatory imposition, and then they went through ex post facto analyses.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
They were both Court of Appeals decisions.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
So unless the court has any further questions, I'm happy to rest on that presentation in our briefing.
Thank you.
So, 2 points that I'd like to address on rebuttal. First, the state notes that shall, it either means one of two things. I don't know that it's quite that binary. When we look at reading law, Justice Scalia and Brian Garner refer to legislative use of the word shall as a semantic mess, and they note that Black's Law Dictionary has five definitions. Black's Law Dictionary, those definitions are: one, has a duty to; two, should; three, may; four, will; five, is entitled to. And so I think what that really tells us is, again, it's important that we interpret statutes in context. And so the context of what is true in these surcharge provisions, that, again, are the only two surcharge provisions in Chapter 973 that function in this particular way, that they're imposed in every single criminal case as to every single particular conviction with specific amounts listed for how much will be automatically imposed. And the distinction the legislature drew in providing a provision prohibiting waiver for the victim witness surcharge statute and not the DNA surcharge statute shows difference in a difference of intention. As to the concern about a lack of funding for the victim witness surcharge, I don't doubt that that was the case, but what that tells us is that the legislature had that concern for the victim witness surcharge statute and didn't for the new DNA surcharge statute. And of course, if at some point the legislature should have that concern, they know what to do because that's what they did. And so it's the business of this court to interpret and apply the law as it stands, not from an outcome determinative standpoint or guessing as to what we think the legislature may have wanted. My second and final point is to the domestic abuse surcharge. That statute functions very differently than either the victim witness or the DNA surcharge statute. So that statute, in order to impose the surcharge, the court, first, it only applies to certain statutory criminal offenses. Second, for all but circumstances where a defendant is convicted of violating a domestic abuse injunction, in order to be able to impose that surcharge, the court has to make particular findings about the nature of the relationship between the victim and the defendant. And only after the court's done all of that does the language say the court shall impose the surcharge. It then provides that a court may waive part or all of this domestic abuse surcharge under this section if it determines that the imposition of the full surcharge would have a negative impact on the offender's family. And so I think what this shows is the legislature cabining in circumstances where waiver would be appropriate in that particular offense or in that particular situation. And that makes sense because when we're talking about domestic abuse crimes, the defendant and the victim may be part of the same family. So monetary concerns that affect the defendant could also affect the victim. And so the two statutes in 973 that look alike in almost every way, that function alike in almost every way, and that were revised at the exact same time are the victim witness surcharge statute and our DNA surcharge statute. And we've demonstrated that the legislature has left sentencing courts with discretion to waive that surcharge. That's what the sentencing court did here. So we ask that the court vacate the surcharge for Mr. Cox. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for very good arguments. When I first saw this case come by, I thought there wasn't a whole lot more to say about it since Scruggs, but it appears there's quite a lot. So thank you very much for good briefs and very good argument. We're going to take a recess now so that some people can leave and others can come in. And we are adjourned.